Podium Publishing presents Duty, Book 2 of the Triss Moon Saga, written by Brian K. Fuller, read by Simon Vance. Chapter 24. Maywen. The Shalane hurried through the sunset-bathed hallway, hiking her dress up above her ankles so she could walk more quickly. Large, arched windows revealed a deep blue evening sky, filled with puffy clouds and shards draped in the warm light of the dying day. Jaren trailed behind her, face grim. The shock of the demon's attack haunted her dreams, and she slept less and less every night, mind and spirit unsettled. The pontiff had delayed the betrothal, while he and Mirel worked to calm the chaos, heal the injured, and bury the dead. But Shalane knew the ceremony would have to take place soon, to restore the people's faith and confidence. 8 nobles from Rugoth, 3 warlords from Ogmir, and 4 Tolnorians died that night in the chapel, and grief and fear racked the people of Kihol as the news spread. But there was something else as well. Jen's name ran through the streets like wildfire blown on a gale. While many had questioned, and even opposed his challenge to the Ha'ulric, there were none who could fault his bravery before the demon. The pontiff saw to it that the Shalane's deeds and those of Ethrys and Jen were heralded from every pulpit as examples of the triumph of light over darkness. Because of his performance at the trials, his challenge of Shatan, and his courage in the chapel, Jen's fame swelled in the minds of commoner and noble alike. The Shalane desperately hoped he would live to enjoy it. At the first preaching of the events that occurred the night of the betrothal, many wondered what the Ha'ulric had done during the entire affair, for the pontiff made no mention of him in his account, save to say that he escaped unharmed. But before long, though from whom no one knew, the tale of the Blessed One, frozen in fear at the sight of evil and lying helpless in his own filth, circulated through the streets. The inaction and fear of the one sent by Eldaloth to be their leader and protector from evil eroded the confidence of the people. If the Ha'ulric could not bear the presence of evil as well as a mage, or even a commoner such as Jen, then how would he fare when faced with the greatest evil of all, even Mikik? Shatan's supporters countered by calling the story of his weakness an obvious ploy of the ilk, perpetuated to weaken the unity and strength that the people would gain from trusting the Blessed One. They even invented a little story of how Shatan had shielded his bride-to-be from the demon's attacks. She snorted in laughter at this fabrication, and her mother swore in disgust. The falsified explanation sufficed for the common folk and settled the arguments on the streets, but the Shalane and most of the nobles of 2 kingdoms knew the truth, and their doubts were far from dissolved, festering anew every day. 2 weeks had passed since the attack, and the Shalane knew of several clandestine meetings of confused nobles, though she wasn't sure what was said. Shatan called other meetings, attended by those he trusted most, no doubt to plan something to strengthen his position or to inform him of any activity against him. But the Shalane cared little about these political manoeuvres and manipulations, confident that her mother would handle them adroitly. She descended the steps into the courtyard where those working to restore the chapel were retiring for the day. They stopped to bow before her. She went by without acknowledging them. Her mind was fixed. In the lower levels of the acolytes' chambers, Jen and Ethrys lay dying. 2 weeks had passed, and neither had awakened. The Shalane had come awake late the night of the attack. Her mother, Jaren, Cadern, and Fenna circled around her. The Shalane remembered 100 questions flooding her mind, but the only one that came out was, "Does he live?" They calmed her and fed her to help her regain her strength, reassuring her that Jen was alive, as was Ethrys, but their faces told another story. It wasn't until the next day when she was permitted to see them, both lying pale and fevered upon the beds of acolytes, that she understood the seriousness of their situation. Runic wards, drawn in white around their beds, protected them from unseen evil, and pure men waited constantly at their sides, guarding lives that continually threatened to flee. They had healed most of Ethris's wounds, but many of Jen's remained. She tried to approach him, but the pure men blocked her way and her mother held her back. "You cannot, child," her mother explained softly but firmly.
"And why not?"
the Shalane said, her voice betraying her frustration.
"Are they to save me and I do nothing?"
"Jen's wounds were many and deep, and I'm sure some of those you could heal. The Pontiff and the pure men laboured through the night, keeping them both alive and healing what they could. Ethris's body they healed, and they will continue their work on Jen to its completion. But there is something, some poison of the demon that works within them, gnawing at them. The Pontiff fears you could be hurt if you tried to heal them. Ethris and Jen have suffered more than bodily wounds, and even the Pontiff does not fully understand it.
Surely something could be done."
The Shalane finally acquiesced, going to Fenna and placing her hands on her handmaiden's shoulders. Mirelle regarded her softly.
"I have sent for Maywen to see if elven lore can shed any light on this."
The Shalane had seen Maywen but twice in her life. The half-elven woman looked no older than Fenna, but she had seen centuries pass. The great King Aldredan Micmir saved Maywen's life during the First Mykikian War. Since then, Maywen, a tracker of extraordinary ability, had served Rugoth in its times of need. It was she that helped them find the Hall of Three Moons on the Shroud Lake Shard, and it was she who would lead their caravan to it when spring came. For 2 weeks the Shalane had waited for Maywen, some answers and some hope. Since seeing Jen that first day, she had gone every day, finding him steadily worsening. Fenna kept a nearly constant vigil at his side, holding his hand in hers and sobbing softly to herself, or staring at him with a defeated expression. The Shalane cried too, though she was never permitted to touch him, for her mother and the pure men did not trust her to not attempt to heal him. Ethris fared better. His fever lessened gradually, and his breathing came more evenly. By the time the first week passed, the pure men had healed both of their bodily injuries, though each had massive scars where the creature's spikes and blades had punctured and sliced their chests and arms during the fight. For Ethris, the scars appeared to be the first he'd sustained. For Jen, they were several of many, and not at all out of place. Today came a brief glimmer of hope. Maywen had arrived and would see them at once. The Shalane fairly ran past the yellowing oaks and fall flowers, going in through the small doors of the acolyte's quarters at the rear of the church and descending a narrow flight of stone steps. She opened the heavy door as quietly as the old hinges would permit, finding her mother and Fenna already at Jen's side. Cadean looked on from a corner, and Jaren joined him as the Shalane took a seat near her mother. Maywen was there, studying Ethris, her mouth bent down in a frown. The half-elf was beautiful, her long raven-black hair pulled back away from a delicate oval face. Due to her elven heritage, her features were thin and elegant, ears slightly upswept, though her human side made her heartier than an elf would be. While her beauty would grace any noble's court, the Shalane knew this half-elven tracker was made of iron, and had endured struggles and fighting for years untold. She wore the colours of the wood, browns, greens, and greys, and her gear lay in a pile on the floor, the tail of long miles upon them.
"Maywen, this is my daughter, the Shalane."
"Yes,"
Maywen replied, voice strangely accented but beautiful.
"I remember well this veiled one. I see she has grown tall like her mother."
The Shalane inclined her head to her.
"It is an honour to see you again. You have served this kingdom long and well, and I hope you can shed some light upon this."
Maywen offered no reply at first, but crossed to stand by Jen, considering him with the same grave look she had given Ethris.
"I have served, and will serve, but I will be of little help here."
At this, Fenna lowered her head.
"Though why so much care for this one? Who is he?"
"His name is Jen. He has served my house with great honour," the First Mother replied. "He is courageous and wise beyond his years."
"Ah," Maywen acknowledged, nodding her head. "Then this is the one whose name jumps like a deer from tongue to tongue. I've heard tell of him as far west as Jarmuth. He was more handsome and a little bigger in the tales, however.
Maywen returned to her seat.
Since you summoned me, I will tell you what I can. But first tell me what happened. In detail. I have caught pieces as I travelled, but I would have the whole of it, without exaggeration or embellishment.
My daughter should relate the events, Merrell suggested. She was less affected than any of us.
The Shalane told the story the best she could, trying to insert every detail she remembered. What was spoken between Jen and the creature was a blur to her, and she was only able to pick out a few words. Maywen listened expressionlessly, though her eyes revealed her interest. When the Shalane finished, Maywen stood and paced about the room for several moments.
Intriguing, and some of it hard to believe. May I assume that the chapel had been cleaned, refinished, and reworked recently, in preparation for this betrothal?
Yes, Merrell answered.
Then you would do well to look at your workers more closely next time. You were the victims of a burqa pattern, and a clever one at that, done by someone powerful.
A burqa pattern? Fenner asked, wiping her eyes.
Maywen nodded.
When Triss was still unveiled, and the war with Mikik and his creatures raged, Mikik's dark elf mages were taught by their foul master how to summon beings from the abyss and force them into battle. Human mages clandestinely observed how it was done, and began to do the same. They learned mental mastery over the demons, forcing them to fight against Mikik's own host, evil against evil. They called the creatures using patterns, a different pattern for each type of creature. The patterns were named after the human magician who first mastered them, Burqa. When Mikik found that the humans had copied the trick, he used his power to create creatures in the abyss itself, demons who could not be controlled using human magic. Instead, they had no mind of their own and were controlled directly by the will of Mikik, like the puppets your children play with. Cleverly, he used a traitor amongst the humans to reveal to them the patterns for summoning these creatures. The humans learned the new patterns eagerly, hoping for a new weapon to turn the tide of the war. You may guess the rest. When the magicians summoned them, they were unable to force their will upon them and were slaughtered, along with hundreds of others. Few escaped. As time wore on, Mikik's magicians became more devious, learning to make patterns upon the ground or on a floor in advance and have them triggered by some event, such as the passing of a certain number of people or the speaking of the dwarven tongue. The mage that created the pattern could be hundreds of leagues away when the trap was sprung. In your case, the pattern was inscribed into the tiles of the floor and activated by the third repetition of the chant. Fortunately for the war, a burqa pattern has two weaknesses. For one, the underworld creature cannot move far from it, the pattern acting as an anchor to its home. The armies of dwarves, elves, and men learned to simply run from the creatures. The second weakness is that those who practice the religious arts can send the creatures back to the abyss with relatively little effort, at least in comparison to how much energy and skill it takes to summon one. War parties took pure men with them wherever they went. The enemy countered with other tricks. When the pattern in the chapel was forming, you mentioned how you were frozen in place, unable to move. This innovation in the burqa pattern hindered its victims from fleeing, allowing the creatures to slaughter all those who couldn't break from the spell. Other patterns were imbued with magic to aid in their effectiveness. Again, the one used against you was created with the ability to destroy the exits from the chapel and drop rubble around the altar and the pontiff so the creature could do its work. You are fortunate that the pontiff is as tough as old roots, or you would all be dead or share the same fate as these two.
Maywen paused to let the information sink in until a voice from the door startled everyone.
What I want to know is how these two were unaffected by the creature's paralyzing magic. Everyone else was, and it seems a bit suspicious to me.
It was Shatan. All present twisted toward the entrance of the room where he had entered unnoticed. His face was angry, and his arms were crossed over his chest. Dacen stood behind him, clearly uncomfortable. All in the room rose and bowed, save Maewyn.
"Welcome, Shatan,"
the First Mother greeted him politely, trying not to further anger one whose manliness had recently come into question. At hearing the name, Maewyn bowed as well.
"So you are the Ha'ulric. Forgive my ignorance, Blessed One. It is an honour to meet you."
Shatan looked her over.
"Thank you, Maewyn. I heard your kind was beautiful, and I was not misled. I should like time alone with you to learn more about the elves."
"Certainly, Your Grace," Maewyn answered.
The Shalane hoped she had time to warn Maewyn before she undertook that visit. Shatan stepped into the room fully.
"But please, Maewyn, if you would address the question. It is rather odd that these two should be entirely unaffected by the creature's presence, whereas all others were frozen with fear."
The Shalane thought it odd that he excluded her, and for the first time she wondered how she had escaped the paralysis that incapacitated almost everyone else.
"It is not odd, really," Maewyn replied, "at least in the case of Aethrys. The magic meant to paralyze the victims of the pattern can be overcome by those of exceptionally strong will, or through counter-magic. Aethrys is a mage, and a powerful one at that. All mages and priests of high skill must develop strong wills to shape the energies of magic that emanate from the moons Min and Duam, as I'm sure you know. As a result of that training and years of practicing his arts, he is strong enough to resist the entrancement."
"And what of Jen, then? I sense you think something is amiss with him."
The Shalane put her arms around Fenner, whose tenseness betrayed the offence taken at the accusation implicit in the Blessed One's question.
"Yes, I was going to ask more about him. I understood from the tales that he was not noble-born. Is that correct?"
"Yes," Mirel answered. "He is a serf, a refugee from his war-torn kingdom Tolnor. Though a serf, he must have had some learning, for he talks as though he were noble-born and is learned. He was also trained as a swordsman and is most disciplined."
Maewyn started to pace again.
"The reason I ask is that the Shalane mentioned that this young man had a brief dialogue with the creature, using the words Umiel and Elder. The language is ancient, the words of the gods themselves. There are two humans I know of who know some of that language, and Aethrys is one of them. Even then, he has studied long to learn what he knows of it. That a peasant boy, not even 20 if I do not miss my guess, should know any of it is unfathomable, unless he has elven blood in him and has been alive longer than you know."
"That would explain many things," Mirel replied pensively. "Talking with him is like talking to no other man his age. No one as young as he should be as knowledgeable, disciplined, or as wise as he is."
A pure man clearing his throat surprised them all.
"Forgive me, Your Grace," he said from a corner of the room. "There are many documented cases in scriptural history of men and women being blessed with the gift of God's tongue in times where they faced great peril. It is considered a miracle and a sign of God's favour. The words put fear into all things evil."
"Thank you for your insight," Mirel said. "I do remember some tales where that occurred."
Maewyn didn't appear convinced.
"What do the words mean?" the Shalane asked.
"Umiel," Maewyn explained, "is a command that translated roughly means flee in the name of the light. Elde is the ancient term for God, the root of Eldaloth. Most likely he was invoking the name of God to command the demon to return from whence it came."
Shatan was displeased at this last answer, face turning red.
"What of the other words, the last ones, spoken by the creature? Chak digat chak ilk mermitcho?"
The Shalane pressed, hoping to further vindicate Jen from Shatan's implied accusation.
"I wish you could remember the first part," Maewyn replied. "The beast's tongue is a corruption of the god's speech and harder to understand. Chak digat means the betrayer.
another name for Mikik. Ilk you know well, I am sure. The phrase seems to say that Mikik will punish the Ilk, though that makes no sense.
I may have remembered it poorly,
the Shalane said.
Ethris will know if he wakes. He seemed surprised by what was said. This can wait until later,
Fenner cried out, emotions raw.
Is there nothing that can be done for them?
You can wait, Mei Wen answered a little unsympathetically. The poisons of the underworld do not just flow in the blood and destroy flesh. They infect the mind and the soul, working evil there as well. Through the aid of your pure men, the bodies have been purged, but only Jen and Ethris can purge what agents work at their own souls. Each must find a reason to emerge from sleep while the poison shows them every reason not to. Now, if there are no further questions, I need to rest for a time.
Thank you, Mei Wen, the First Mother said. Ask for Pure Man Feldsman at the door. He will see to your comfort.
Thank you. Honour to your house. May Eldaloth keep you, Shalane. Ha Ulrich?
Mei Wen gathered her things quickly and left. Shatan's eyes followed her out.
Well, Dacen, we shall leave the matter of Jen to another time, unless, unfortunate of unfortunates, he dies. What a shame that would be.
Shatan left, but Dacen lingered long enough to bow to the Shalane, eyes pained. Jaren scowled at him. The Shalane inclined her head slightly as he left, finding herself missing his company again. When Jen had fallen, she had expected that Dacen would be reinstated as her protector until he could be healed, but Shatan refused to release him from service, and Captain Tolbrook had taken over as Jen's replacement. Silence reigned in the small room as the acolytes trimmed the lamps and returned to their somber vigil.
Go, Fenner, Merel said kindly, stroking the girl's hair. Eat and rest. I will watch for you. Take my daughter with you.
Fenner thanked the First Mother, and she, Jaren, and the Shalane left. The girls took the meal in the Shalane's apartments. The Shalane sorrowed to see how little Fenner ate, and how the girlish exuberance that had always been a part of her nature had died. When the meal was over, the Shalane commanded the protesting Fenner to sleep in her bed.
I will watch over Jen in your absence, she promised, and take heart. He is strong. He will win the struggle against the poison, I'm sure.
Fenner nodded and closed her eyes. The Shalane stayed by her side until her face slackened and her breath slowed. Quietly, she donned her veil and stepped outside. For all her assurances to her handmaiden, she feared more and more for Jen's life.